Al 51esimo Festival Internazionale di Musica Contemporanea di Venezia si è esibita la pianista e performer Margaret Leng Tan. Il suo concerto era un tributo e si intitolava Through the Silence, John Cage in Memoriam, 1912-1992. Leng Tan è infatti considerata l'interprete d'elezione dei pezzi di Cage e di tanta musica d'avanguardia americana. Ha conosciuto il compositore nel 1981 e ha collaborato con lui per 11 anni, fino alla morte dello stesso artista. La pianista, originaria di Singapore, suona tre diversi tipi di pianoforte: quello classico, il pianoforte giocattolo e il piano preparato. Del pianoforte preparato, un'invenzione di John Cage, ci svela la nascita e i segreti. Del toy piano, il pianoforte giocattolo, è la prima e forse l'unica vera professionista. Parlandone, citerà una frase di Marcel Duchamp che suona così: «Gli strumenti poveri richiedono una maggiore abilità». Durante le sue performance utilizza anche radio, fischietti, bacinelle d'acqua o mazzi di carte. Margaret Leng Tan ci rivela anche l'essenza di Chess Pieces, composizione nata da un dipinto di John Cage. L'intervista è stata fatta da Marina Andragi Camara per Radio Papesse. L'audio è l'originale in inglese. Buon ascolto!
I'm Margaret Leng Tan. I'm a pianist who lives in New York, originally from Singapore. I am recognized as, how shall I say, one of the leading performers of John Cage's music, because I knew him for 11 years, from 1981 till his death in 1992. I'm a pianist who also plays the toy piano, and I am fascinated by the challenge of turning a toy into a real instrument on which one can make real art. I've also become recently more and more of a toy instrumentalist as well, because I like to challenge myself. I think Marcel Duchamp said it very well when he said, poor tools require better skills. So to be able to create art on a toy and make art that's convincing, I think is for me a very interesting challenge, and I'm fascinated by this challenge. I also play the piano in unusual ways. Besides using the keyboard, I also play inside the piano, on the strings of the piano. The piano is a very versatile instrument because you can treat it, besides being a piano, you can also treat it as a harp, as a percussion instrument, and even as a bowed instrument, where you can bow the strings and create the most extraordinary sounds. So the extended possibilities of the piano are another of my areas of fascination. I make a tribute to John Cage in a program that I do called Through the Silence, John Cage in Memoriam. This year, 2007, is John Cage's 95th birthday, if he were alive today. In this program, I try to introduce the music of Cage in all its variety and diversity just through the piano alone. So I try to select works that represent his oeuvre, whether it be the prepared piano or the idea of making theater at the instrument, or even using the most abstract concept of star maps to create a music that is to a great extent indeterminate, where the player has the responsibility to be co-creator and make music out of a score that John Cage has made that's very beautiful visually, that is made from the stars, from star maps, star charts. So this is pure abstraction, but it's an interesting way of being able to play God and make order out of the chaos. I also, in this program, play Cage's music, the one serious piece of music he wrote for the toy piano, which was the first ever serious music made for the toy piano back in 1948, because this is the inspiration and the grandfather of my entire repertoire as a toy pianist. One of the pieces I introduce on this program is John Cage's chess pieces, which was totally unknown up till 2 years ago. It's actually a painting that John Cage made back in 1944 of a chessboard with music embedded in it. And this music is actually very painstakingly and carefully put into the painting. And for a long time, nobody even thought this was playable. But I deciphered the music in the painting and found it was actually a lovely, interesting piece of music. So I like to introduce this art music to audiences, because John Cage is also very much of a visual artist, especially in his later years. This painting is different from his artwork of the later years because it's a very concrete painting, very visually direct. It is a chessboard, and you can recognize it as a chessboard, whereas his later paintings are abstractions, or rather his prints and etchings are abstractions created by chance operations, the same procedure with which he applied to his musical compositions, he also applied to his artwork, where he would use chance operations to determine certain parameters. For example, in his Fire series, he would have chance operations determine, for example, how long a hot object, for example, a kettle, would be placed on the paper, how long it would be placed there, and then when you remove it after the specified time determined by chance, what you have left of the paper, sometimes very little, would be the work of art. Or whether how close the candle flame would be brought to the artwork and for how long it would be held there before then it would affect the paper, to, you know, based on these chance operations. So he made art very much in the way he composed, using chance procedures that he set so that he could divorce himself from emotional involvement with the creative process. And when you look at some of these works of art or listen to some of this music, it's really quite amazing that even though these works are made with a deliberate intent to not become emotionally involved with a piece, sometimes it conveys a tremendous amount of emotion. Because fire is a very powerful element to use. And when you apply it and you see the angry ring that the kettle has made and how charred the paper is and how it's falling apart, it makes a statement. Both visual, both poetic, and emotional. Even though he did not want that to be the source of his inspiration, emotion. I decided it would be a good idea to let the audience see the painting of chess pieces unfolding square by square as I am playing it through the 64 squares of the chessboard, and then to see the complete painting. I feel that it would not be complete just to play the music without any reference to the artwork. And the other piece I did, the Etudes Australis number 8 of John Cage, I felt it was important for the audience to see the score, which is very abstract and very beautiful graphically, because it's made from these maps of the stars, and it may appear totally random how John Cage did it, where he put the music lines, where these stars would have fallen on these star maps. and then to leave it to the performer to become co-creator, to share the responsibility, to turn this into music. I find it an interesting challenge because John Cage has given you very, very disciplined parameters on how to work with these star maps. It's not that you can just do anything, that even in the use of chants, John Cage was extremely disciplined and he expected no less from his interpreters. So how would I interpret these star maps? Well, John Cage uses the principle of time equals space, which is actually a very Asian concept, that time and space are not separate entities, but they are coincidental. They exist parallel to each other, that they're inseparable. Time and space are really one and the same. And this begins to sound very abstract, but he uses what is called space-time notation in the star map music. If time equals space, then you have to measure the distance between the notes. And the distance you measure with a ruler, and the spaces become proportional distances, not only in physical space, but in time space. And then you know whether to play the notes close together or far apart or more spread out or very close together based on this idea of proportional distance and space equals time. Does that make any sense to you? For In the Name of the Holocaust, this extremely moving and powerful piece by John Cage, I have to prepare the piano with bolts and screws which are inserted between the strings of a grand piano, so it completely transforms the sound of the piano and makes it into a new instrument, a prepared piano. I thought it would be interesting for the audience to see how it's done, because how often do you get to see a piano being prepared? So this gave them a chance to have a close-up look and ask me any questions about it. The objects I use in the name of the Holocaust are the bolts and screws, or screws with a loose jangle on it that makes a terrible, frightening noise when you play it loud. All this is what John Cage wanted you to use. The piano was screaming and painful. It was, isn't it? It's a very powerful piece, In the Name of the Holocaust. It's a very powerful emotional statement. Yet, in an interesting way, John Cage was always insisting on being apolitical. And he would never admit anything about this piece. In the end, the music has to speak for itself. And I think it certainly speaks for itself. He always said that the title, In the Name of the Holocaust, was a pun. You know what a pun is? When you play on words. He always said that In the Name of the Holocaust, the title In the Name of the Holocaust, was a pun on James Joyce's phrase, In the Name of the Holy Ghost. In the Name of the Holocaust, In the Name of the Holy Ghost. So he's playing with language. But I think the piece speaks very loud and very clear what it's really about. The prepared piano is an invention by John Cage back around 1938, 1940, around that time. It's not quite clear exactly when he wrote the first piece for prepared piano, which is Bacchanal, the piece that opens my program. Bacchanal is a wild, exciting piece, and he made it out of necessity. Because at that time he was in Seattle, Washington, on the Pacific Northwest coast of America, and he was at a college, an arts college, called the Cornish Institute of Allied Arts. And he was the music accompanist and composer in residence. And there was a dancer, a black dancer called Sivilla Fort, who wanted him to make dance music for her dance, which was going to be, as he said, somewhat African in nature, very, very energetic and rhythmic. And at that time, John Cage was writing music for percussion instruments, whether they were found percussion, like flower pots, coffee cans. He had a whole percussion orchestra of very unusual objects that made sounds by hitting them or beating them, you know. So he wanted to make percussion music for her, but there wasn't enough room for his percussion instruments and the dancer because it was a very small stage. So he could only use a piano, a small grand piano. And he didn't want to just write piano music for her. He still wanted to make something that had a percussion sound. And he experimented and he thought of the idea of putting a nail between the strings, but it was smooth and it fell through. Then he tried a screw, and the screw has a spiral on it, and was able to stay in place long enough for the piece to be played, and that's how he invented the prepared piano. So Bacchanal is written for pieces of felt placed between the strings that deadens the sound, with a couple of bolts that jangle and ring. So it's a very interesting combination. And that's his first piece for prepared piano. He went on to write many, many, many dance pieces, especially for Merce Cunningham and other choreographers, using the prepared piano. And his idea was to create a percussion orchestra under the control of a single player. And I think he did succeed in that. John Cage wrote Water Music in 1952, and it's a very important piece because it is the forerunner for happenings in the 60s and performance art in the 70s. So it's a theatre piece. And John Cage really did believe that art equals life equals theatre. He believed very strongly in the three being inseparable: art, life, and theatre. So this piece uses the radio because the radio is very much a part of everyday life. And by using the radio, it's a very disciplined use of chance, because he tells you exactly when you have to put the radio on, but you will never have two performances the same, because the radio will never be the same twice. And the actions that the pianist has to do, whether it's blowing whistles, pouring water, playing some notes on the piano, those are all fixed, but the radio context will always be different. So this is his way of introducing controlled chance into his work. Ever since John Cage's Suite for Toy Piano, written in 1948, ever since I discovered that piece, I became fascinated with the magical sound of the toy piano. And I got my composer friends excited about the toy piano, and they all started to compose for me, making wonderful pieces, not only for toy piano, but toy piano and other toy instruments as well. And on my CD, which The Art of the Toy Piano, which came out 10 years ago in 1997, I have marvelous pieces, whether it's for toy piano or toy piano and big piano together, the real piano and the toy piano combined. It's a very special combination, quite magical. And then I have pieces by other composers who wrote for me like Guy Krusevic, who is an accordionist, wrote a piece for me for toy accordion and toy piano and kitchen percussion. And I have now pieces for everything, from toy piano with toy harp to toy piano with bicycle bells and bicycle horns and train whistles. You see, you can make art on anything if you work at it, I believe. And my most recent challenge was to make this piece by the Chinese composer Ge Kanru. He made a piece for me, which is a melodrama, where I sing in Chinese opera style, and I play 17 toy instruments, like a toy orchestra, to accompany my voice. Everything from toy piano to toy harp, which he treats like a Chinese zither, to toy glockenspiel, and all kinds of really interesting percussion instruments, and even some really beautiful sounding but cheap $1 toys, like a paper accordion that can only play two notes, but the most sad, haunting two notes you ever heard, like something out of La Strada, that kind of atmosphere. So I find this challenge quite fun and also joyful, and I wonder where it will lead me. I'm not sure. But for now, I'm having a good time. I use the word new music in a different context than I would use the word modern music or contemporary music. Modern music is an umbrella word that covers a lot of things. Contemporary music is, to me, the serious music. Contemporary music is what a lot of European composers write. To me, new music is more, non-academic, more inspired by the pioneering maverick tradition of John Cage. To me, that's new music. I use it very separate from, in my mind, from contemporary music, which I basically regard as very serious academic European music coming out of, say, a 12-tone tradition of Schoenberg. And not to say there are not American composers who write in this style, but to me, this style is basically something that is very much rooted in Europe. It comes out of a European tradition. Whereas John Cage broke the connection with tradition, with European music, which America was very much dominated by in the 40s. And even the 50s. John Cage, I think his greatest gift is he gave American composers the freedom to be themselves and the confidence to be themselves, not subject to the great yoke and responsibility of the European musical heritage, which comes all the way back to Bach, Beethoven, and then into all the way up to Schoenberg. So John Cage freed American composers from this feeling of being always influenced by Europe. I can't say at the moment, because that would mean that my taste changes all the time, which it's not true really. I would just rather put it this way: of the composers that I admire, the composers who have written for me in very performer-specific ways have been, for me, a great gift. I inspire them and they inspire me. And sometimes it's collaboration that we make together. I don't particularly, for myself, like to play music that is very intellectual and comes from the mind first. For me, music must first make me react viscerally from the core of my being. If I don't react physically to it and feel some emotion, then I find it difficult to get involved with it. And that's my problem with a great deal of European music. It's much too complicated for my little mind to understand and to be able to not only understand the music, but understand why is it being created. So I play very little European music because there is very little of it that I want to play. With the exception of one composer who is not particularly well known, but who writes the most beautiful, spiritual, deep, soulful music, and that is the music of the German composer Hans Utter, who is now 80 years old. And I think his music is a great gift to the world. I have learned a great deal from John Cage, not only in the world of music, but also in his philosophy, which is a Zen-based philosophy. It's taught one to be more forgiving of oneself. And an example of that, I would like to say John Cage's definition for error is quite wonderful revelation to me. John Cage's definition of error is simply this. Error is merely our inability to adjust immediately from a preconception to an actuality. And when I first read that in his book which is full of pearls of wisdom, like this, in his book Silence, I thought, that is the most forgiving philosophy and piece of wisdom I've heard in a long time. Error is merely our inability to adjust from what we think it should be to how it actually is. So, in other words, there are no wrong notes in a concert, if you take that literally. Or, as John Cage says, everyone is in the best seat in the audience. It doesn't matter where you sit. No matter what you may hear from where you may hear differently from somebody sitting there in the other corner or from what you hear from your corner. It doesn't matter. It's all valid. So it's a very all-encompassing, very generous philosophy of life. And that is, I think, one of the most important things I've learned from John Cage. To accept everything, whether we like it or we don't like it. In other words, John Cage says, we have to accept equally what we like and what we do not like, instead of always forming very strong judgments about things. It's a way of being open. Not that he didn't have his likes and dislikes, he certainly did, but he also tried to be very open in receiving experience and information. So I try to be a little bit like that too. Well, Cage never saw himself as a teacher in the sense that he never told you what to do. You know, he saw himself as less a provider of answers than someone who posed questions. Because in giving you questions to think about, that's how you grow. Not that he would necessarily give you straight, complete answers to everything. He would rather like you to create questions for you to think about, and you find the answers yourself. I would say that anybody who wants to understand John Cage's music should also read his writings, because I don't think it's possible to have a full picture of what John Cage is about if one doesn't also read some of his very wise philosophy as expressed in his writings. And his book, collection of writings called Silence, is a wonderful collection that one can revisit many times and still learn something new each time. So I would highly recommend Silence, that collection of essays to begin with, if you want to learn a little bit more about John Cage's philosophy and understand his music a little deeper.
Radio Papesse è un progetto di Ilaria Gadens, Carola Haupt e Cristiano Maggi.